As an introduction to this and next week's tributaries, I quote from Mary Taylor's and Richard Freeman's website, "Beneath it all, we always remain students, practicing, studying, experimenting, inquiring, relearning, and then practicing some more." And that is how these two authors and teachers show up. This is Robin with Tributaries. Mary and Richard, thank you for joining us for another Tributaries, and thank you for bringing yourselves to light in your new book, When Love Comes to Light.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, thank you.
It's such a great title, not unlike the Bhagavad Gita itself, multi-layered in interpretation and in life. And what was the motivating factor that made the decision for you to write this book, bringing the wisdom of the Gita into modern life?
The traditional thing was to memorize it, and I had maybe a portion of it learned. And then recently, we've started to see how it really applies to all of the crazy situations that we've encountered, you know, with different types of people and different than misinterpretations of religion and all of the fighting and conflict that comes because people don't really understand what is metaphor and what is not, and they get lost in language and ego. And it's almost like an epidemic within not just the yoga community, but also, of course, in the international community, this great misunderstanding or misuse of religion, mysticism, yoga. That was very sad. And it just seemed that the Gita, that was the main point of it.
And in popularized books, you know, self-help books, actually, a lot of times, there is this sort of idea that why doesn't our life come with a guidebook like you do for your computer, a guidebook for life? And so many of the other ancient texts, that's what they are.
Yes.
But because they are shrouded in religion and in traditional interpretations, often they're not interpreted as modern day guidebooks. When you start peeling away those layers of preconception that are overlaid onto some of these texts and the Gita in particular, what you start seeing is these issues and problems that we have now or any day, the crises that we meet, that is part of the human condition. And those things have been happening in different forms, but similar forms forever.
Absolutely.
And there have been great thinkers addressing them forever. And so that's kind of why we started looking at it in this way. And the more we got into it, it would be very funny because we'd be working on one chapter about some particular thing like demonic issues or demonic people. And then someone in our immediate awareness would do something that was fitting that exactly.
You know, yes,
we go,
yes.
Yeah, thank you. Let me write that.
Right.
Could you repeat that? Insight.
Well, I love that all this beautiful wisdom, which you just said was shrouded as a self-help book, but it's shrouded in story. And the Gita actually predates all religion, doesn't it? This is it, folks. This is life. And it's not creating any dogma. It more so much feels like an offering.
Yeah, the actual Gita does that. But of course, every school has their interpretation of it. They don't look real closely at the text, and they try to make it a justification for fighting. The first chapter is misinterpreted, or they try to say, well, my guru is omniscient, and then they'll misquote the Gita or something. And so the story that the Gita is part of is the Mahabharata, which is actually the longest book in the world. And that's a very complex, messy myth. It's almost like modern politics. It starts out spoken in a battlefield rather than a rose garden. And just before the battle, everyone on both sides gets all macho and they start blowing their conch shells, just like you would think, oh, this is just every day in ancient India where they fight with each other. And then Arjuna breaks down. He has like a crisis of compassion and he knew something was wrong. And so he asked his charioteer, who also happens to be Krishna, conveniently,
right,
to draw the chariot between the two arms. So Krishna pulls the chariot up. And then Krishna, so everyone can hear him, he says, look at this one family. And so he's looking at both sides and he says, this is all just one family. And it's like, whoa, okay. Then that changes the whole situation because it's no longer you should just hate the bad guys and kill them,
right,
on either side. So he's pulling it up in the middle path between the two armies. So our original working title of the book was The Middle Path of Love. And of course, with an obvious tip of the hat to Mahayana Buddhism, to the Madhyamaka. So one of our background theories that we didn't explain in the book, but we could write a whole thing on it, is that the poet who created the Mahabharata knew Mahayana Buddhism inside and out, and he was using all kinds of terms and paradoxes and references to the Buddhist schools at the same time, as well as other schools.
Yeah,
he's very clever.
Again, taking the opportunity to not create divisiveness, but to create communication between sides.
Between schools.
Between schools. And so it's an interesting theory. Who knows? Writing a book like this, you end up reading and rereading and rereading the original text so many times that you start seeing some of these things in different ways. And that was one of them.
Yes. I wondered what it was like for the two of you to be writing this book together. I'm sure, as you just mentioned, you read something over and over. And because of the wisdom and beauty that this is, of course, it's multi-layered and all of the wisdom goes in every direction in life. How was it speaking your interpretation, Mary, to Richard and vice versa? And how did that play out? How did that work?
It was good. You know, we had talked about it a lot before we began the project. So we kind of knew the direction we were heading in. And before we began writing, we together went through the book and tried to outline how we would get from point A to point Z, figuring out what we thought was at the beginning and what we wanted to have an emphasis on for the end, and then how the book led us there. And then we took old lectures that Richard had done on the Gita in a course and transcribed them so they were part of the original scaffolding. But when we've taught the Gita in courses before, it's never been taught in full because, number one, there's never enough time. But number two, when you look at the Gita, it becomes extremely redundant, so it seems. In the first three chapters of the Gita, most of the topics have been revealed that are going to be discussed throughout the book. So as an impatient modern reader, you say, okay, I already know about that. I heard about that in chapter 3 when you're looking at it again in chapter 15 or 16. And so often the end of the book gets shortchanged for various reasons in a lecture type setup. So we didn't have a full series of talks on it, but we did have the outline and we did have these transcribed talks. And then Richard started working on the translation from the original text into English, which he'll never say it, but I love his translation of it because it's one of the only ones I've read, or the only one I've seen, that really is written by someone who practices asana and meditation and pranayama and chanting and has the depth of experience that Richard has had with the practices of yoga, rather than it as a philosophical endeavor. And so that is often not emphasized in translations.
And there's some good translations.
Yeah, they're wonderful.
But a lot of them use very theistic language, a lot of these and thous, and are kind of catering to the Europeans in the early 20th century. And so they overemphasize certain things, which at the time was useful. But they make it sound rather what's the word?
Stiff.
Stiff. Yeah. It has a lot of jokes in the actual names and things.
Yes, and it shows. I mean, it shows in your writing, especially in the first section of your book, where you are giving some modern life insights into the wisdom, or vice versa, how the wisdom shows modern day insights into life. Many, many kudos your directions, both of you, but it definitely shows. And it is important to have that tactile experience in order to really talk about what you're talking about.
On the same line of thinking, you know, the tactile experience with modern life is also what we try to bring in as well. And that's kind of where I am more able to contribute on that level, is like, well, how does this really impact my everyday experience, or students who've come to me with crises, or family members or friends who I've seen go through different things? How do these situations relate? And one of the things that struck us at the very beginning as we were starting to work with this and to write the prose part of the book was that Krishna is the teacher for Arjuna, as well as his friend, and happens to be this great, you know,
avatar
and figure in mythology. But one of his primary functions is he's the teacher, and he wants the best for his student. He wants the student to learn, not by giving him a dogma, but by learning to ask questions and learning to get an answer and then ask again. And as a teacher, one of the things you start recognizing is that, or as a human being, as you're trying to solve a problem, or a teacher trying to help someone solve a problem, you have to work on these different dimensions of understanding in order to solve the problem. So we attempted to bring awareness to the fact that for all of us, we have our philosophical underpinnings that are part of our way we approach the world. And they are our way of seeing the world philosophically. And then there are beneath that, this foundation of things like beauty and truth and meaning that support the ability to have philosophical and theoretical approach to life. And then on top of it and interwoven into it is our own personal story. And to solve any problem, one must work on these three levels, not separately, completely have to work with them as a unit. And so that's what we tried to weave in, because that's what's presented throughout the book, those different global themes, philosophical themes, personal themes, the personal story. They fold over each other as if you were folding something into a batter.
And it keeps coming back to the immediate experience, just as in yoga practice. Krishna says, I am the sweet fragrance of the earth. And so you have a direct experience. And rather than saying I'm the source of the sweet fragrance, or I'm the sound in space, the taste of water, all of these are immediate experiences that we ignore unless we're in a good practice, a good meditation practice. So we ignore them.
Because it takes too much effort.
Yeah. And the whole idea is that Krishna's saying, what is arising right now is me. Is this whole amazing, indescribable experience that will completely stun your mind. And then in the 11th chapter, Arjuna thinks he got it. Of course, it turned he didn't quite, but he said, let me see this for sure. So he got the gift of the divine eye, and he started to see in the body. And by that time, you knew that Arjuna's body was the body of Krishna, and he started to see infinity in all of the different layers and levels of his immediate experience. And it blew his mind, so he had to start over.
I hate when that happens.
And then,
yeah, almost there, and then it's like, oops, never mind.
And I'm just thinking that that's a very famous chapter, but people also don't fully understand that what it's telling you is that you're having a direct experience through sensation. feeling, and then even that you're having a direct experience of this indescribable vibrance that is sacred, that is awesome.
And it's not always pretty.
No, it is not. But it's, yes, but in the beholding, when we can honestly know that, but we can go our whole lifetimes really and not allow ourselves to know that. Once we can start doing that, then we're not so freaked out when something really horrible or weird happens. We're able to move forward, not from a reactive place, but just from that deeper knowing place. You know, when you're talking about this, it reminds me of something you wrote in the book about the nature of harmony being not two, not one. And it's like, oh, now wait a minute. There's a lot being said about it not being two, but there's not a lot being said about it being not one. So explain yourself.
Yeah. So one is pretty boring. Yeah. And so the teaching is that of it is not two, but it is two, but it's not two. In other words, it's relationship that's being taught. There's no thing there. It's all this vibration of relationship, of communication, of interaction. And if you say it's one, then you're reducing it to a theory that makes it kind of
separate.
Strange, yeah. And so that's a common misinterpretation of the Vedanta or the old teachings.
And it's also, you know, a way of getting any of us to look at and start to be comfortable with the idea of being able to hold paradoxical states of mind without becoming freaked out. Mm-hmm. In other words, things arise, and a perfect example is you are this completely separate on some levels, completely separate body and human being in your form that you were born in and are still wandering around in the world. And yet you are not separate from the world. And the more you become self-identified with either your thoughts or your body or your emotions or anything like that, you become more restricted in your ability to then interface with the other, as Richard's saying, to have a relationship with other people, with the environment, with other sentient beings. And so, you know, you have to hold on some level the idea that, yes, you are separate from everything else, because indeed, in a certain way, you are. But if you hold too tightly, then you run into problems. On the other hand, if you say, oh, it's all one man, and I'm just part of the jungle here, and I'm part of the world, and it's all one big thing, and I'm just part of it, you'll walk out into the street and get run over by a bus. So you have to be able to, you know, see this paradoxical state that you live in all the time, and yet not become attached to either side of it. And so that's where the harmony is when you can, it's almost like you're dancing between these two sides of a paradox. And when you can do that, you become comfortable with the underlying teaching of that capacity to be comfortable with paradox, which is to be comfortable with not really knowing what is going to happen next, or not really knowing anything for certain, and yet being very certain. So it's, again, paradoxical, but also letting you become comfortable with process rather than identified with or holding on to specifics.
Yes, and going back to the problems with dogmas, every moment is fresh and brand new, so it requires a fresh and brand new attention. So when we have experience, we have a better attention, perhaps. And yet there cannot be really many formulas for truly living. because each situation really is new.
And I think that that's really well said, and Robin. And I think that one of the things that this time in history with the pandemic, and in our country as well as others, with the social unrest, the Black Lives Matter movement, et cetera, that have been going on all over the world, and people at this stage with the pandemic, with lockdowns, et cetera, feeling a sense of exhaustion because we're waking up to the fact that we have to be malleable in this way in order to really see what's arising and respond immediately and as skillfully as we can in the given moment. And cultures and societies have been moving along so quickly over the last number of, you know, generations that we haven't been forced to wake up to the present moment. And this time in history is pushing that to the foreground, yes. That this is really what life is about, is waking up to what's happening right here, right now. And if there's a sense of fear or anxiety from the fear or resistance to that, which there's bound to be because we've been trained to not wake up, then we can start to feel overwhelmed or exhausted, etc. And one of the things one can do is just to pause and look around and get some resilience back from the communication with others, whether it's communication with nature or with other human beings.
So still, you're going to be making theories. Mm-hmm. And you got to, you know,
you
they
to.
Keep popping back
yeah.
up. And that's also considered sacred in the Gita. But because you understand the truth of relationship, you're willing to communicate about your theories. Maybe the best thing to do is this and this. And then somebody says, no, maybe this is better. And because you're not attached, you don't have an ego investment in political theories or even health theories, scientific theories, you still make them because that's also a sacred function. And you still do actions, but they're more experimental in that you're willing to really make an adjustment if somebody says, ouch, that hurt. Don't do that. And people go, oh, sorry. And again, you're not like trying to force other people into a position. You're just trying to actually communicate with them.
Right.
And so, you know, the inevitable keeps coming. The fact that we create more systems and more religions, but then we're also able to let go of them. That may become useful. We can let go of them and adjust. Oh, the term is upgrade them.
Right, right. And that certainly is what you all have done in writing When Love Comes to Light by bringing this wisdom of the Gita into the modern life, which is the subtitle of your book, of course. That is what is so important, because there have been these avatars and these very spiritually high people all throughout time, always roaming the earth. And we need to hear it in the modern language so it can really sink in a little easier. You all have done such a beautiful job using words in your book. I had to laugh when I was writing this down because I thought, they did such a beautiful job using their words. I thought, very nice, kindergartners. Let's move on now to color. But it definitely expresses that you all know of which you speak. And I'm wondering if you could share a personal experience about your own readiness of heart, which you write about in your book.
Well, I think that, like everything, is a process and comes in wave patterns. And so readiness of heart really would be rooted in, number one, the visceral experience of being able to drop into your physical experience of the moment and trust whatever it is that arises within your sensation field, all of the different sensations that you have and how that interplays with your thoughts and with your emotions, and essentially how that feels inside the corporeal existence of your own experience. And once you have that and you've had a taste of it, it's not something that it happens once and then, oh, good, for the rest of your life, you just walk around in this bliss state. It's this sort of waking up to the, again, a sort of multidimensional, multi-layered experience that we have available to us. And once you have it, then you start, quite by chance, actually, I think, at least my experience is, noticing when out in the world, and these things start to happen when you do a contemplative practice. And many people, I'm sure, who are listening to this broadcast are people who do some form of embodied experience, yes, or contemplative practice. And once you've had that experience, you know, you run into two problems. One is that you want to recreate it, and then that becomes a big problem. Or you think that I've had it, therefore I don't have to practice anymore because I've already had it, I'm enlightened. And those are stumbling blocks, because it is this response to the circumstance that has sparked that experience. And so once you've had it and realize what it tastes like, then you start noticing it elsewhere. And you're not grasping at it, but you start feeling it elsewhere, and it sort of spills out into other aspects of life. And that's when it starts to feel more grounded and more consistent and more real, because it is something that is not something you want, but something that is actually allowing you to be of service and allowing you to be connected to the world in a very intimate way. So that's been my experience with it. It's something that sort of arises, and then let it be and let it go and not hold on to it. And then maybe it comes again. And if not this lifetime, maybe again in the next life.
Yeah. But yeah, it might be coming again, but in a different form.
Yeah.
Of course.
You're not,
yes,
noticing.
Because it's always there. You just haven't seen it.
You're not looking. Yeah. I think, you know, one place where we experience it, and everyone does to a certain point, is sometimes just getting to look at some other people, you know, that you've kind of been a little bit shy about or have miscategorized, and then actually communicating with them. And there's actually some kind of spark, you know, if only for a second, in which you go, oh, they're me and I am them. Like in Thailand, we would occasionally experience people who were actually tribal people from Myanmar, hill people. And they didn't speak Thai, and they didn't speak, but they were so sweet once you
looked them in the eyes.
Once you, yeah, you know, just tried, it was like, wow. And so I think that's what the world needs, is for people to take the chance. I don't know whether it's reaching out or being diplomatic or...
or being open.
Yeah.
You know,
being skillful.
Not cutting oneself off. You know, and it's Brené Brown's idea of allowing vulnerability. Why not take that risk and be authentic? Because it feels good on both sides. You know, you're missing out if you don't.
In relation to like the Black Lives Matter and the huge divisions that are being created here, and in fact all around the world, you know, the people who want to control, they create these divisions where people refuse to reach out to each other because the other is so terrible. And then when you hear about someone doing it, it's like, oh, it makes your day.
Yeah, and one thing about having to wear a mask, you can catch so much of someone when you do connect eye to eye, right? You can just see the smile. Part two next week with Richard Freeman and Mary Taylor, authors of When Love Comes to Light. For any guest information, to listen to archives, share resources, or sign up for weekly programming, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Podcasts are on iTunes, and if you don't find us on your favorite podcast place, let us know. This is Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.